This is NHL Radio.
Time now for NHL Hour with Bill Clement and Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Home Ice.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the NHL Hour. This is Gary Bettman along with Bill Clement. We're coming to you live on NHL Home Ice, XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com. And we're coming to you from the NHL store powered by Reebok in Manhattan. The call-in number is 1-877-645-6696. That's 1-877-645-6696. We'll get to your call shortly. And later on, we'll be joined by the Executive Vice President and General Manager of the San Jose Sharks, Doug Wilson. But we have a special guest, Bill, before we get started.
That we do. I just was Brian Burke always punctual when he worked for you? Because he is extremely punctual today.
Well, he's always punctual, and he's a good person. Brian, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me on, boss. Hey, Billy.
This wasn't a command performance. I was actually hoping you would join us so I could ask you, Brian, what's up?
Well, it's been an eventful couple days. I just felt there was a couple of slow news days there, and I thought I'd liven things up for you, just doing my part.
Well, actually, you've taken all of the attention off the possibility of a second franchise in Toronto. So why don't you tell everybody what happened from your perspective and what you see as you look into the future?
Well, I guess to give a 30 or 45 second version, I mean, basically, and Gary knows this and Billy knows this, I have children from my first marriage that live on the East Coast. I travel back 2 weekends every month to see them. I've been doing that. This is my 11th year doing that. And the Samuelis are wonderful people, great owners. I think the greatest owners in pro sports. And my boss here, Mike Shulman, was terrific. I said yesterday at the press conference, the best boss I ever had, and I got an email from Gary right away because he was my old boss. But
you always said I was your best boss. You hurt my feelings.
You were a great boss.
Yeah, thanks.
I had a great situation here. We have a good team. The community's been fabulous, but it's too much for me, and so I was offered a very generous contract extension, but I told the Samuelis on the first that I was going to try to get back farther east and try to get my kids in the same time zone anyway. And so their internal decision was to promote Bob Murray, which I support completely, and they wanted to do it sooner rather than later. So I was actually lecturing at a sports management conference in Toronto, and Gary, you were kind enough to speak there. And they asked me to come back Tuesday night, and we had the press conference yesterday. So the timing was dictated by ownership, which I think they're entitled to do. If they'd asked me to stay on all year, I would have. It puts me in the marketplace sooner and allows me to, you know, unite my family sooner, and I'm grateful for that. Bob Murray, I think, is the right guy for this. So now what has to happen next is, because I am still on the payroll and employed, no team can contact me unless and until the team here is given permission. My information is, Gary, they're going to do that with you here in the next few days. And then we'll see. I don't know what the future holds. There's lots of rumors flying around, but we'll see.
You know, there are a lot of people who would suggest that with the economy being what it is and there only being 30 general manager jobs, that perhaps you had taken leave of your senses from a security standpoint. How do you feel about that, and do you have any concerns about the uncertainty?
Well, I had to work without a safety net once before, and for the listeners and the fans that are listening to this, you know, I worked for Gary for 5 years as a senior VP of hockey operations in New York, and I have said this frequently, so I'm not just sucking up to Gary because we're on the radio together. Working for Gary was like getting an MBA.
Well, that just means you suck up on a regular basis.
possibly. So, but I mean, you know, I learned so much working for Gary. He's such a smart man and a good guy. But I missed being on the team side, and I remember I talked to Gary after the Olympics in Nagano, and I said, you know, I think I want to get back on the team side. And Gary said, okay, you understand now what that means. He said, this job cannot be a parking lot for out-of-work GMs, and you're right, and it hasn't been. Obviously, Coley's been there the whole time since and done a great job. But, you know, Gary said to me, this can't be a turnstile job where a guy who's out of work comes in and does it for a year. So if you start looking, I'm going to start looking. I said, that's fair. So that whole spring, I wasn't sure what would happen. Had four kids at that time. But I had confidence in my abilities. And I ended up being a finalist in Atlanta and getting the Vancouver job. And I'm willing to work without a safety net again here. So I'm confident that I've done enough here that I'll get a chance somewhere else. And willing to take that bet.
Bill, do you have anything you want to ask Brian before I let him go?
Brian, is there a sense of relief with all of this, a sense of disappointment? Where are your emotions relative to what has transpired over the last week?
Well, my big fear, and I know exactly what you're getting at, my big fear, Billy, is that my players understand that I didn't pick the timing, you know, that I didn't walk out in the middle of the season. This is what ownership wanted. It makes perfect sense to me, and I just wanted to make sure our players and fans understood that you know, I signed a four-year deal. If you sign a four-year deal, you should do 4 years unless the employer decides otherwise. And this is what the Samuelis wanted, and I have no problem with that. But that was my biggest fear. And there was some relief telling, you know, the Samuelis have been so good to me to say to them, finally be able to say it and get it, you know, that burden off your back that I am going to take this step. I am going to try to go back to a team in the East. There's some relief there, too. So, you know what this job is like. It's a crushing burden. It's 24/7, and to wake up one day and realize that someone else has set a problem for 1 or 2 days, and 2 weeks, or a month, or whatever the time frame is before you accept that burden elsewhere, it's not all bad.
There you have it, Brian. Thank you for joining us, and of course, we wish you nothing but good luck.
Thanks, boss. Thanks, Billy.
Thank you, Brian.
So, Mr. Clement.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about you for a second.
What have I done now?
Well, it's what you're about to do. In 1975, you were on the Stanley Cup winning team. You never had your day with the cup, but I understand that day is coming in New Hope. You want to share with the listeners what's going to happen and why you decided to do this?
Well, actually, I wasn't owed anything, but I was fortunate enough to be on the 74 team as well. And just watching players with their day with the cup, I remember saying to you about, I don't know, a year ago, do you think it would be possible for me to have the Stanley Cup for a day? And you said, yep, let's look into it. So we started looking into it. I called Bernadette Mansour. And
I said that?
Well, you were breezing out quickly, and I think you wanted to get back to something. So, yes, you did say that. You said, no, ask Bernadette Mansour and then Phil Pritchard at the Hall of Fame. So it is coming to my area. It's actually going to be in Jamison, PA, at the Middlebucks Institute of Technology from 11 to 5 on Saturday. I have an unbelievable committee. This has been a labor of love, raising money for two charities in my area, the Network of Victims Assistance, known as NOVA, and the JAG Fund that raises money for brain tumor research. And we have an unbelievable day planned. Rather than go into it with everyone, I will just say the details are at Stanley Cup, Bucks County, B-U-C-K-S, as in Big Bucks, not me, the county, StanleyCupBucksCounty.org, and it is going to be just sensational. The things we have planned. A congressman gave me for our silent auction on Monday two tickets to the inauguration.
Really?
Yep, coming up on January the 20th.
And you've set up a website for this?
We have a website set up, not for the silent auction, but the raffle we have set up on the website. People are buying raffle tickets. The grand prize for the raffle, and it's Philadelphia-centric, obviously. It's a suite for 14 people to a Flyers game in January. Super stretch Hummer limo transportation to and from the game and after the game, and I approached all five of these players personally. Mike Richards, Jeff Carter, Danny Briere, Marty Biron, Riley Cote, they are going to meet the 14 people after the game. Those are the kinds of things that we have to offer that day, and there'll be raffle tickets available on site that day.
Well, then I'm glad I said you could have the cup.
I am thrilled that we had to work out scheduling and everything because the cup is so incredibly busy, but it is the most. I'm going to call the show the NHL live show tomorrow, and I'll be in the limo on the way to the airport to pick up the cup. It's arriving tomorrow.
That's incredible.
It really is. I can't believe it's here.
So good luck with it.
Thank you.
And it sounds like you're really putting it to good use.
Yep.
What would you like to talk about?
I want to let people line up because the board is lighting up, but we have a little more room. The number to call is 877-NHL on XM. That's 877-645-6696, 645-6696. The versus rating on the game on Tuesday, the Detroit-Pittsburgh game that was fantastic.
The rematch of last year's final. the highest rated Versus game for the regular season since we've been on Versus.
As it should have been. It was a sensational game, which as I watched the game in the third period, I realized one of the greatest changes since the work stoppage, and with the rules changes, I truly believe that we were a two-period sport. Teams were 28-1-1 after two periods, 31-0, and now, and we see it more and more every week, we're a three-period sport again.
As it should be. Well, you know, people say to me all the time, you know, how many goals do you want? How many goals? And it's not about counting the number of goals. It's about the trending. Is goal scoring trending up or down? It's about scoring chances, and it's about lead changes. I think that was the fifth time this year a team had come back in the third from a three-goal deficit to win a game. And that's what you like to see.
Little firepower helps.
Well, but it also keeps people on the edge of their seats.
Sure.
We had the last Stanley Cup final before the work stoppage, Tampa against Calgary. The first team to score a goal in each of those seven games won the game. There was no give and take.
Right.
So it's good to see.
That it is.
We also we seem to have a shutout streak going for Roberto Luongo?
Well, we did.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, he set a Vancouver Canucks record. He's just, when Roberto Luongo is on top of his game, he is the most intimidating goaltender and a most imposing figure that is guarding the crease in the NHL, and he has been that lately. The Canucks are alive and well with Roberto in goal. I wanted to get your take on something, too. Again, the phone number is 877-645-6696. The board is lighting up. Get in line now, 877-645-6696. We're about ready to take your calls. But
I think we threw people off with our change of format today.
Probably did. This is the shocking news coming out of Russia on the test results. So the 49 players, they're going to test a total of 67, and the final results should be in by tomorrow. But five of the 49 Russian players tested apparently have heart defects. What's your take on this, and what do you know about? Can you enlighten us on anything coming out of there other than that report?
I don't know anything more than that report.
It's shocking.
It is. There's got to be something more to it.
I hope so.
There needs to be some explanation. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and it certainly defies any statistical probabilities
sure.
that you could do.
That's 10%.
It's incredible.
Well, I'm hoping that they do further testing, that they prove not to be accurate, because it's amazing.
Who is the source of that report?
It was Safin, the head of the Continental League. Is that his name?
Medvedev?
No, not Medvedev. I read his name the other day, and he was official release from the Continental Hockey League.
Maybe something got lost in translation.
I hope it did.
Okay.
I hope it
did. What are we doing now? We're going to the calls. Derek in Calgary, thank you for calling in. This is the NHL Hour with Bill Clement and Gary Bettman. You're on XM204. How are you?
I'm doing well. I just have a quick question for you, Gary, and maybe, Bill, you can have some insight input on this as well. I'm just completely and totally baffled how Timmy Thomas's name did not make it on the ballot. I know everyone has a chance to go down and vote and put their player in there. Don't get me wrong. I love Patrice Bergeron, but Timmy Thomas should be there before Patrice should be there. And I just don't understand how he's not one of the main names that's on the ballot that's there in print. And the goalies a lot of the goalies that are there, he's beating them in every category, not only this year, but last year as well.
I'm sorry.
I think it's a disrespect to Timmy Thomas's performance of how he's performed. He's performed like an all-star, not just for the Boston Bruins, but for the league.
No disrespects intended to Timmy Thomas or any player who's not on the ballot. The preliminary setup of these ballots is done over the summer, so we don't have the full benefit of what's going on in the first month of this season. And there are only a certain number of players per club that you can put on. There's consultation with the general managers. Hockey operations does it in consultation with communications and public relations. It's not an exact science. We try to get it right, and there are always some curious aberrations in terms of what the process is. But the good news is, with online balloting, You can vote for whoever you want. And again, the point with a printed ballot is they've got to be printed far enough in advance, and there is an element of unpredictability.
And are there X number of goalies on the list, X number of forwards, X? I mean, is there a finite number by position so that Tim Thomas was locked out by?
Well, it's a combination of by position and by team, because you can't have,
right,
you know, 20 players on from one team. It is a balancing act. And again, to the extent that, fans think that we've missed the boat on somebody, we apologize. And to a particular player, no offense intended.
Do you have any idea what the percentage is of paper ballots that are cast compared to online ballots?
It's all online. Yeah.
Then all of those callers that come in and that come on and you say, great idea. My idea would be to allow everyone to be on the ballot. If it's electronic, could everyone not be on the ballot?
I think having 700 players is a little cumbersome and unrealistic.
You've got to be able to vote for your fave.
And while we may miss some players who deserve to be considered All-Stars, I think your suggestion, I wouldn't say this to a caller, but I'll belittle your suggestion. the fact is, I think you belittle the process if you suggest that everybody has the potential to be on the All-Star team.
Well, at least broaden it.
Well, okay. But, you know, you need some realistic limitations. Why don't we take our next caller? John from Nova Scotia. You're on XM 204, Sirius 208 with Bill and Gary. How are you?
Not bad. Thank you for taking my call, gentlemen. It's always a pleasure to get an opportunity to talk to you. My question is about hitting from behind. I'm a Leaf fan, and the suspension in regards to the Mike Van Ryan hit was at least acceptable. There's always been hitting in our game, and I appreciate that. And I've heard many people call in and say, well, you know, they're much more vicious now than they were in the 50s and the 60s. And I think that they really, other than the equipment, the only thing that's changed is the size of the players. So the viciousness looks at that. But the hitting from behind is—it's unbelievable. I can't fathom what I've been seeing, and I guess I'm a little heavy-handed sometimes. But I thought with the McSorley incident, which wasn't a hitting from behind incident, but I thought the league had an opportunity at that time to lay down the law to make sure that things like this never happen again. A gentleman who was towards the end of his career should have been eliminated from the game, period, completely. And that would have stopped it. If the infraction warranted it, something like that, then that should have been the sentence laid down. Now, we have a player on our team right now who's been guilty of hitting from behind, and if it were him, same thing. Throw the book at such a level of speed that the person that it hits doesn't get back up. And if that is the law, or if that's what the law is going to be, then the hitting will stop. I will hang up. I'm on my cell phone. Thank you again for taking my call, and I can't wait to hear your comment.
Well, thank you for calling in, and thank you for your comments. You packed a lot into that question, and let me try and deal with it, which may be a little bit of stream of consciousness for me. I don't think the players are more vicious. They may be bigger, but I also think the bigger change that you didn't refer to was television. In the old days, lots and lots of stuff went on in the game that nobody ever saw because the coverage of the game, both in terms of the number of games televised and the extensive camera work, didn't let you see everything that was taking place on the ice, and you didn't have the highlight shows and YouTube and the like on the internet. So things that happen on the game are now everywhere, and they're constantly repeated. So there's a greater awareness, and there's a greater exhibition of everything that takes place on the ice. Long-winded way of saying it gets magnified. Also, slow motion makes our game look a whole lot different sometimes. Excuse me. When a player changes direction and gets hit, and he gets hit in a way that hurts him, everything that happened probably in the blink of an eye. But when you break it down in slow motion, it typically looks horrible. 1,000 times worse than it was in real time. Not necessarily the consequence of the injury, but the dynamics of what happened on the ice between two players. I'm not exactly sure I understand the McSorley point. Because,
well, I think it was throwing the book so hard that it would eliminate it. But when has punishing an indiscretion led to an elimination of the indiscretions?
Well, two things. McSorley, if my memory serves me well, was suspended for a year and never came back.
Right.
So his career, in effect, was ended by the incident with Brashear. We have punished very severely reckless hits to the head and hits from behind. Last year, your team, Bill, Philadelphia, was the recipient, Steve Downey and a couple
Scott
of others.
Scott Hartnell, Randy Jones.
Multiple game expense. Downey was 10 games. Hartnell was, I think, close to double digits, if not double digits. The point being, there is a certain type of conduct that we will not tolerate. Hitting from behind is part of it. But there's a dynamic to playing the game that things happen in the course of our games. We don't want intentional hits to the head. We don't want players getting injured needlessly. And the interesting thing about the hit in question on Van Rijn was a question more of, if you ask Toronto, the punishment wasn't severe enough.
Right.
And if you ask Montreal, no punishment was warranted and it was too severe. There's never going to be complete agreement on these issues, and that's why I think Coley Campbell does a very good job. He knows the game. He has a feel for the game. He understands what is appropriate in the game and what isn't. And as a result, he makes these judgments all the time, and he's consistent, bearing in mind that no two of these incidents are exactly alike.
Let me say this about the comparison of the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s. There's far more. I played in the 70s and the 80s, and far more hitting now. And coaches demand that the guy without the puck finishes the check. They also demand that the guy with the puck does not cough it up, have composure, make a play, do not turn it over. When these two
and
things
keep your head up
and hopefully do that, but when these two things converge, you've got a defenseman reversing his feel to try to get away because he doesn't have a play. You've got the player trying to finish the check. And very often, you'll end up hitting a guy as he turns, and you'll hit him from behind. That said, I believe it takes about a nanosecond for a professional hockey player to make a decision to let up a little bit. So you can let up. But make no mistake about it, there is far more hitting, and therefore, and people finishing checks, players holding onto the puck longer. So the opportunity for these kinds of hits is far greater now, TV or no TV, than it was in the 60s or the 70s. We're going to take a break. This is the NHL Hour. Commissioner Gary Bettman is waiting to take your calls when we come back. Callers, stay on hold. We appreciate your patience. You're listening to us on XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com.
This is Andrzej Kopitar with the LA Kings, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now back to Commissioner Bettman.
Do you like the Grateful Dead?
Love them.
Do you? Good. Were you a Deadhead?
Not a chance. I love them, but I wasn't a Deadhead.
And now?
I have a big head. It ain't dead yet.
There you go. Maurice in Maryland, you're on with Bill and Gary. This is the NHL Hour. XM and Sirius with two different numbers.
Yeah, hi, Gary. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I have an idea. I also want to discuss the hitting from behind.
Sure.
Where you have a hit that involves an injury, I have an idea that may curtail it. If the team has to suffer, in other words, the guy who does the hit gets penalized by the referee, should the game go into time, the team that did the penalty plays shorthanded for half of the overtime. If it goes into a shootout, you take one shooter away. So instead of having three shooters, they have two.
You know, it's an interesting suggestion, but I think it's more a question of curtailing the conduct, not how severe we could trump up a level of penalties that actually and potentially unduly influence the game. We don't want hitting from behind. We punish it severely. If there's an injury, there's supplemental discipline, and players will lose potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars in salary. Their team will suffer by not having them able to play. And so this isn't a question of us not feeling that there's adequate penalties, and this isn't a question of us not wanting to get this type of conduct out of the game. But as I said before, every instance is different. And when you look at the nuance of what takes place in a give and take, you've got to evaluate what the context of the play was, what exactly happened, and was the injury, which is a factor, a logical consequence. Because, for example, if you have a guy who's playing with an injury, who's just come off a concussion and may be more susceptible, the type of injury may be greater than, you know, somebody who's playing and is perfectly healthy. And so there aren't easy answers to this other than we punish severely and we don't like this type of conduct.
Frank Brown brought up a good point during our last break, and that is that so many players that go unmentioned and virtually unnoticed by most people watching let up on the guy. There are far more people that let up on a hit from behind than actually make contact. And let me say this as well. There are players in the NHL that want to help their team so much and that are tough enough that set themselves up to be hit from behind. There actually are players that do that. So it's a tricky call when you're trying to make that call as to what to do with it.
That's actually a very fair point. Why don't we take Chris from New Jersey? You're on with Bill and Gary, XM 204, Sirius 208.
How you doing, Gary and Bill?
We're
good.
Okay. How about you?
I'm driving through the fog here.
No, where in Jersey are you?
Out of Trenton, but I'm actually driving through PA right now.
Oh, no, that's how I got to go home. How bad's the fog?
It's bad. It's like soup.
Well, then I want you to pay attention. Ask your question and then put both hands on the steering wheel.
I got you.
Okay.
My question actually has to do a lot with the team, you know, television. It just seems like there was a lot more coverage when the NHL was on ESPN as far as the after shows and everything else, whereas on Versus, it's, what, 2 days a week?
Typically.
That you can watch the game?
Typically 2 days a week, except during the playoffs, they go wall to wall. Versus does a terrific job covering us. ESPN has everything. And, you know, the era going back to the mid-90s, early 90s, when ESPN2 started, and they basically built that network on NHL hockey by showing NHL games every night. That era has been long over because ESPN and ESPN2 have so much programming, they have everything. We went to Versus after the work stoppage because it was a much better deal for us, and Versus was able and willing to give us the type of priority treatment that ESPN can only give football and baseball. From our standpoint, we've seen Versus dramatically improve its coverage, that it's terrific in terms of game broadcasts. And with respect to distribution, when we started with them, they were in 60 million homes. They're now in 75 million homes. They're available in another 5 million homes. It's working out much, much better than I think it actually gets credit for. We have a very good relationship with ESPN. They swear that their journalistic news coverage of sports isn't limited to the properties that they have the rights to. You'll have to draw your own conclusion. They were a good partner when we had them, but the times changed. I never rule anything in or out for the future, but we have this season and at least two more to go with Versus, and we're happy with that relationship, and that relationship only gets stronger as, again, evidenced by the fact that in last year's playoffs, our ratings were getting comparable to what we were doing on ESPN, ESPN2, and the Pittsburgh-Detroit game earlier in the week did the highest regular season rating that we've ever done on Versus. It's a relationship that we are extremely pleased with and has only gotten better over time.
You always knew it was going to be a process.
Of course.
It wasn't a switch that you were able to flip.
I use that line a lot.
Switch or process?
Both.
Okay.
Let's go to Walt in Missouri. You're on with Bill and Gary. This is XM 204, Sirius 208.
Hi, Commissioner. I'm glad I finally got a chance to talk to you because I've got a lot on my mind. I think the league needs to do something about the hitting from behind. I know my team has been victimized probably more than any other team in the league. But yet, you know, if a blue does anything, and then the league makes an example of them. We've lost too many good players in their careers because of cheap shots and hitting from behind. Al McGinnis, the last example, and the league did nothing about that. Nick Kiprios, who hit Grant Fuhr, the league did nothing about that. We had an incident during a game where a player got a stick trapped in his visor. again, no call by the ref. Nothing happened. But if the Blues would have done that, the guy would have been thrown out of the game and probably suspended for the entire season. I think the league needs to be more fair with the teams, and I think another solution for the hitting from behind problem is maybe eliminate them from postseason contention. That way it kind of balances the league a little more, and it gives maybe some of the lesser teams a chance to get into the playoffs that wouldn't normally get in. If you got a goon on a team that's really good, maybe that team will say, hey, you know, we can't tolerate this kind of stuff, you know, play the game right. You know, you get a hit from behind, especially in the playoffs, that team ought to be eliminated from the postseason. I think that's the best penalty of all.
It's an interesting point, but I guarantee you if we instituted that rule and penalized the St. Louis Blues, you would claim that we were biased. And the one thing I can tell you, actually there are two things that I want to say in response to the comment. We don't tolerate acts that cross the line, be it hit from behind, hit to the head. There's always going to be a dispute as to what was a legitimate and not a legitimate play, what was a clean check and what wasn't. And we enforce those rules, and the officials enforce the rules and call the games on a completely unbiased basis. Obviously, beauty is going to be in the eye of the beholder when you're a fan. There's no question that, and it's one of the great things about our game and our fans, is the passion that people have for the game and their rooting interest. But our officials and the league office could not care who wins or loses. We just want the games played fairly and with integrity, and we think we deliver that. That doesn't mean the officials don't make mistakes on occasion, but I assure you what mistakes they make are not from any bias against any team or against any players. And again, there are certain acts that don't belong in the game, and when we believe they occur, we punish them.
Wouldn't do anything to JD anyway. Well, good friend of ours, come on.
JD's
never go out of our way to do anything negative towards JD.
We seem to have a thematic here. Morley in Edmonton, I understand you want to talk about hits from behind also. You're on with Bill and Gary.
Hello, Gary.
How are you?
I'm not bad.
Good.
Okay, so scenario. Oilers playing. Stortini's out on the ice. He goes, he hits somebody from behind. You suspend Stortini. It's not going to hurt the Oilers that bad. You suspend, say, the captain with Stortini, and then the Oilers are going to hurt. And then Stortini's not going to do that again. Or say Crosby, or you know, respectable captain of any team. You suspend the captain with the player who hits from behind.
The answer to your question is the player who deserves to get suspended gets suspended. And if you have a player as you're describing it who constantly is committing acts that are inappropriate, particularly if he's not a skilled player and has no other role in the game and finds himself in situations where he's doing things he shouldn't, he will have a short career because we believe in progressive discipline. And the more times you commit an act that's inappropriate, the more harsh the penalty gets. So a 2-game suspension turns into an 8-game suspension, turns into a 20-game suspension, and on and on and on. And you've seen cases, I won't mention any players' names, where the discipline has gotten worse and worse and worse because the player didn't seem to learn by the prior punishments.
Interesting idea. I wonder how many guys would be lining up to be captains in the NHL if Morley's idea flew.
Well, and in fact, you know who you would make as the captain. It would be the player.
Stortini.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Tom in New Jersey, you're on with Bill and Gary, XM 204, Sirius 208.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Are you driving in the fog also?
No, I'm in southern New Jersey, sir.
Okay, good. No fog in southern New Jersey.
Not yet.
Good. What can we do for you?
I had a question for Mr. Clement about the possibility of Flyers acquiring Brendan Shanahan. How do you see him fitting in with the Flyers, and would they have to move somebody to get his services? That was my question. I will hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Depending on how much Brendan would be willing to sign for, they might not have to move anybody. I think they've only got about $1.something million left under the cap, so Brendan would have to come in at a discount what he was used to. Where Brendan would fit in, everybody needs leadership, and Brendan is one of the most respected voices that's ever played in anybody's locker room. So that's what the Flyers would be getting. They'd be also getting somebody that would be another power play weapon. And apparently the Flyers are down to the short list of teams that Brendan Shanahan is considering.
And he's a good guy.
Great guy.
He really is.
Yeah, he'd be a great addition to any hockey team. Although I will say this, if Brendan only plays 7 or 8 minutes and is more of a power play specialist than anything, it's tough to have as great an impact as a leader when you're not logging the ice time. That's just a fact of life in the NHL. You play a lot, people look up to you immediately.
But don't you also have to weigh in as a factor age?
I mean, as far as the playing time?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. No, reality is, it is what it is at Brendan's age. So he will not be, wherever he goes, a 16 to 18-minute ice time guy.
Are you surprised at the Flyers' start this year?
Yes and no. They had a lack of continuity in the blue line. They lost Randy Jones and Ryan Parent before the season began, and then they started to go down up front. So there's been lack of continuity everywhere. Marty Biron was not off to his best start. So listen, it's the fine line, and I'm holding up my fingers. My fingers are, index finger and thumb are tight together. That's the width and the bandwidth of the line that separates teams from winning and losing in the NHL.
I'm glad you explained that. Otherwise, I'd have to remind you we were on radio.
I got that part.
I know you do. Mike in San Jose, you're on with Bill and Gary, the NHL Hour. Or not. Mike in San Jose. Get you next time.
Mike, we were going to get some nice questions from you to ask Doug Wilson when we have him on, coming up at about 7 minutes.
Chris in Ontario, you're on with Bill and Gary. Hopefully you're there.
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks
Good.
For taking my call, guys.
Thanks for calling in.
Hey, so I have two, I guess, suggestions. And first off, it's got nothing to do with hidden from behind. My first suggestion is about the extra point awarded for an overtime loss. Now, that was implemented before the shootout came along. Any intentions on only awarding a point for a team that went the distance through overtime and lost in the shootout, and a team that simply lost in overtime to not get a point? And then my second suggestion is regarding a neutral site. I know at the start of the season where teams are playing over in Europe, any thoughts on all 30 teams playing one game at a neutral site? Obviously, it wouldn't work if they all went to Europe, but there are some markets in North America that obviously can't have a pro team, but definitely have arenas that can support a game like a Winnipeg. I know they have a nice arena in North Dakota or even London, Ontario. Just wondering what you thought of that.
Well, actually, and I'll take the second question first, we had a history of playing neutral site games in the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken, and we concluded that our teams, as a general rule, do very well in their home markets, that their fans want to see the games, which is why we played in 93% of capacity. And the benefits in terms of playing in neutral sites compared to the burdens, taking away a home game, travel, being in unfamiliar arenas, and having the ability to build on these, you know, just playing one game in a particular site is an interesting event, but we don't think, in terms of North American markets, it makes a whole lot of sense. What we do in Europe, we do for other reasons, so that we can connect the fans who really have no other way to connect with us at all. But we actually played the neutral site games and then decided it didn't make a whole lot of sense. And in fact, I think the clubs are happier to play at home. With respect to the extra point, the theory on the guaranteed point going to sudden death overtime was when we were moving to 4-on-4 with the guaranteed point, we wanted clubs to go for it. There was a tendency before that when we got to the overtime sudden death period, teams would both sit on it. They'd be happy with the tie and each team getting a point. This way, with the guaranteed point, we hoped teams that would open it up. The suggestion that we've heard most often, although we think what we have now is working pretty well, is that you get 3 points for a regulation win and then 2 points for either an overtime or shootout win and 1 point for an overtime or shootout loss, so that every game would be worth 3 points. We decided it was too complicated, and we think what we have now has been working very well, and there hasn't been much pushback, particularly from our fans, about it.
My brain is cramping already at the thought of a 3-2-1 system. So
well, then
I'm glad we're moving on.
That's good enough reason not to do it.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Frank in the Hamptons, you're on with Bill and Gary, XM 204, Sirius 208.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Quick comment and quick question. Gary, I think the league is great where it's at. What a great product, a magnificent sport. I'm in the New York Rangers market and the season ticket holder, and I just love everything about the game and the changes that you guys made, and I think you guys are doing a great job from top to bottom.
Thank you.
My quick question is the league looking at or addressing the issue of these lightweight sticks breaking so often and so easily?
It drives us crazy.
Yeah, doesn't it?
It drives us crazy for two reasons. One is it's very expensive for these new composite sticks, and they break with great regularity. And two, when you see a player about to do a one-timer, he's wide open, play's been set up, and then the stick snaps, you've lost the scoring opportunity. And what we're hoping is that the stick manufacturers, and I actually had lunch today with one of them, are working on ways to make the sticks more durable, keeping them light, giving them the flexibility that the players want, but somehow making them more durable, because we would prefer not to see them break as often as they do. You know, I'd love to go back to the old wooden sticks, but I'm not sure that's going to happen anytime soon.
It won't, because the trade-off for the broken sticks is that everybody is launching 90-plus mile-an-hour shots. It's unbelievable. You can't even see the puck anymore when most guys let it go.
Although, interestingly enough, Al MacInnis once said to me, he said, I had asked him if using a composite stick would make any difference, because he used a wooden stick. He says, no, it's only the guys that don't have a shot that it helps.
Al didn't need any help.
Exactly.
We're going to step out when we come back. The general manager of the San Jose Sharks, Doug Wilson, will be joining us here on the NHL Hour on XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com.
For the New York Islanders, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now back to Commissioner Bettman.
Well, thank you, Rick. I actually saw him on Tuesday. I went to
I saw you talking, speaking with him. You were on camera.
Were we?
Yes, you were.
Oh, no. But he's a good guy.
Very animated. Oh. You guys look like you were getting along.
We always get along.
Good.
You know, my reputation obviously precedes me inappropriately.
No, I didn't say that.
It's our pleasure to have Doug Wilson, the Executive Vice President and General Manager of the San Jose Sharks, join us. Doug, are you there?
I am here. I'm enjoying the music that you guys play. Who's selecting that?
Gary.
Well, you know, that just means you're almost my age in terms of your musical taste, and it's also probably that San Francisco influence on you being out on the West Coast.
Well, I'm just trying to keep up with my kids here, so.
I know the drill. You know, before I start asking you questions, I find the ability to talk to you today a little fascinating, because you are so multidimensional. In addition to being the general manager of the Sharks and obviously doing a great job over time in the start they have this year, you were a player of great renown, having played, 14 years in Chicago and then finishing your career in San Jose. And you were the president of the Players Association. So we have lots to talk about on a variety of fronts. Is there any one of those topics you'd like to start with?
No, I will just share this with you. I am a classic product of experiential learning, and I learned by osmosis. I was very fortunate that some very good people came into my life at key times and mentored me and shared their knowledge. So I'm not sure how bright I am, because I never wore a helmet, but all I know is that good people spent time and helped me in my formation.
Well, notwithstanding not wearing the helmet, what goes into making a decision as general manager for a coaching change? And you made a change. You brought in Todd McLellan. Take our listeners through the process that you went through, both in terms of the firing and then the subsequent hiring.
Well, first of all, with all due respect to our former staff, and they did an excellent job. At that point, I said that sometimes the class needs a new professor and the professor needs a new class. And I think it was just it was a time and place that a decision had to be made, and in this position you have to make those decisions. It's no surprising that Ron has gone on to Toronto and done very well. We looked at philosophically where we wanted to get to and how we wanted to play as a team, and we were trying to become a team that's a very talented team with a blue-collar heartbeat. When we went through the evaluation of the coaching candidates, it was a very extensive list. There's some very qualified people out there. We liked the idea when Todd's name came up that he came from an organization that truly worked and was committed to working and functioning as an organization. He had worked with the Minnesota organization before under Doug Risebrough and Jacques Lemaire, and he understood how they had operated too. When we sat with him and I looked at him, and he's a real guy. He has great clarity in his communication. The experience that he had last year with Detroit winning the Cup meant an awful lot to us. And the other thing is that he attracted very good people. The three assistant coaches that we had, Jay Woodcroft came from Detroit also. Trent Yanni came from the Anaheim organization that had just won a Cup 2 years ago. And Todd Richards came from Pittsburgh, where Pittsburgh had been to the Stanley Cup Finals and their farm team was in the Calder Cup Finals. So there was a lot that went into it. We're very pleased with our staff. It's not something I want to do on a regular basis, but I feel that this staff is the right staff for this team.
What's the process you go through in hiring and or finding a new coach? Do you target someone, or do you do wide-scale interviewing? From your standpoint, how should this process work?
Well, we looked at it that you always try and work backwards and say what it is you're trying to accomplish. And it was a combination of, one, philosophy on how to play the game and the type of person. So we had a very broad list that actually started off was probably close to 40 people in total. We got it down to 20. And we also, out of respect to people that we're going to interview, we would never interview or request to interview somebody who was still coaching. Detroit last year played longer than anybody else. It called Kenny Holland and told him that I'd be requesting permission to interview Todd when the appropriate time came. And Kenny was tremendously respectful about keeping it in confidence, but he also gave us the green light to not only interview Todd, but his video guy, Jay Woodcroft, who's come in. So it took a long time to do it properly, but it was well worth it because you garner a lot of knowledge talking from some very intelligent hockey people that were also candidates in this process.
You know, the conventional wisdom, and you know what they say about the conventional wisdom is it may be just silly, but that it generally takes a club a good couple of months to adjust to a new coach. Do you buy into that, or are you surprised by the great start that the Sharks have gotten this season?
Well, I think we're not quite there. We're not fully ingrained to do things automatically. There's still a little bit of thinking before we play, so I still think our best hockey's ahead of us. I think a credit goes to Todd and to the players. One, the players were very receptive to Todd coming in. I also think that Todd started building his relationships a long time before he actually got out here for training camp. He took the time to get to know the players. The players know that he wants them to succeed. He's very demanding, especially of our best players. He holds them all accountable. But he knows in their hearts, though, that he wants them to succeed both individually and collectively as a group. And I think that goes a long way to his success.
Any surprises to you on the team this year? Anybody performing better than you ever imagined?
We have pretty high expectations for our players. So I would say a Devin Setoguchi, who we have strong belief in is going to be a great player. He's playing with Joe Thornton and Patty Marleau, and he's already scored 9 goals. So we think he's probably playing at a high level. But we think all our players have another gear in them. Our first 11 games that we won, we had 11 different guys scored the game-winning goal. So it's more of we're a sum of all our parts right now, but we think some of our parts can gear it up.
You spent 14 years in Chicago and then the last 2 years of your career in San Jose, and then you never left. What was it like going from an original six team to a team that was new on the scene? What was it like going from a hockey hotbed like Chicago to the Bay Area in Northern California?
It was a tremendous challenge, but it was the best decision I ever made. It was approached, when they approached me about coming out here, it was to be in the ground floor of something brand new, to be a pioneer. And many people should never forget the importance of that first year that we had, that we played down in the Cow Palace, the Kelly Kissios and Dean Evasons and Rob Zettlers. The relationship that they built with our fan base that continues to this day was really important. It was a great challenge. That first-year team was one of the closest teams I ever played on. We lost 17 games by one goal, but I never forget how it started here. And our fans have been so loyal right from day one that every year when we start to build our team, we take it very seriously that we have to put a team on the ice that they're proud of.
You are also president of the Players Association, and if my memory serves me well, during the work stoppage in 94. What was that like for you, and what kind of responsibility did you feel to your players in the game?
Well, to me, I look at it that we're all in this together, and the reason I got involved in the Players Association, I'll be honest with you, was I think my brother was mistreated with some of the things that he had to go through and some of the teammates that I played with, and without going into the detail of that, I've always felt if you take the time to get educated on issues and be able to listen to all parties involved, you can find a solution that works. So I take great pride in that time frame. I work with some wonderful people in this league, and when I say that, that's on both sides of the fence for how it was viewed at that time. But we do have to listen to each other, and there's things in this game that, especially with this economic climate we're facing right now, the partnership has to get to the next level and find solutions that other leagues and other businesses are dealing with. But never forget that our fans are very important, and I work for people here in San Jose that have done a great job of remembering that, and I guess that's what I gathered back in those days working for the PA.
What's the most challenging or difficult thing you have to do as a general manager?
You know, my job, I think, is pretty simple. It's just really find some bright people, let them do their job, give them the support they need, and don't micromanage. One thing our entire organization truly works and understands is the responsibility, I think, to make San Jose be a place that players want to play. So you've got to be committed to winning. You've got a great fan support. I think you've got to have a great community involvement. And you got to have a lifestyle out here. So I guess on a daily basis, doing the things that make this be a place that players want to play, because they do have choices under this system, and treat them with the respect they deserve.
Doug, I'm going to ask you one more question, then I'm going to let you go.
Sure.
Did you ever imagine you would be a general manager, particularly when you were playing?
You know what? I never did. And, you know, the job I enjoyed a lot, and I enjoy this job and the challenges that come with it, I really enjoyed the development side of working with young players and seeing them, you know, get better. And that was something that I thought would have been maybe my final job in this business. But this opportunity came along, and I enjoy it. It is challenging, but I work with great people. But it's the game of hockey has been wonderful to me, and I'm proud to say that I'm part of this league.
Well, Doug, thanks for being with us. We're proud to have you as part of the league, and good luck with the Sharks this year.
Great. Thank you, Gary.
Doug Wilson, general manager of the San Jose Sharks, and we're out of time. One caller had a question. What would Bill do if he was commish? So I made my list here. I'd lower ticket prices. I'd expand to Las Vegas. I'd hire myself as a VP with a no-cut contract because I know that I would get fired my first day on the job as commissioner.
That was very profound.
I mean, I just protect myself going in.
We'll see
what we can
do for you.
What do you got coming up this week? Same old, or is there anything big on your plate?
You know,
I mean, it's all big, but
I look at my day, my life, in 3-hour increments. 30. I've got to go back to the office now, and I have a dinner meeting tonight. That gets me through the next 3 hours.
And I've got to drive through the fog to New Hope, Pennsylvania.
Nobody would ever accuse you of being in a fog.
Oh, yes, they would. All right, that's it for today. We're going to be back with 15. You next Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern for the NHL Hour. We love chatting hockey with all of the fans, and I speak on behalf of the commissioner when I say call us, okay? We'd love to hear from you next week. That's it. Have a great week of hockey. This has been the NHL Hour on XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com. Espo and Rossi are up next.
For more podcasts, check out NHL.com. This is NHL Radio.